This is In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne and Rochelle Riley.
Another Sunday afternoon and conversation you care about. Glad you're with us.
Oh, Marie, I am so excited. Star Trek is coming back.
Is that why we have the music?
Yes. Yes. Da, 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 da. Let me just say, CBS.com is going to bring back, well, they're not bringing back, it's like a Back to the Future moment. They're going to do a new TV series with new Star Trek characters, but it will be like the fourth incarnation of Star Trek.
Absolutely.
You know, there was Star Trek Next Generation, Star
right.
Trek with Avery Brooks. I don't even remember what it was called. I just loved him. Well, they're going to do this after the next installment of the feature films, which now, you know, the new features.
Exactly.
Starring Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto, who are wonderful as Captain Kirk.
And
Mr. Spock.
And, you know, you've got to wonder, what is the enduring spirit of this show that makes it so relevant to all these new generations? I mean, our generation, our kids, and now young, really young kids.
You know how we talk about conversation you care about? Gene Roddenberry created characters you care about. So
right.
No matter who embodies them, there's something about them going out to explore strange new worlds
yeah.
and go where no one has gone before that you want to go with them. You know, even if the people are weird and have pointy ears and, you know, they might want to eat you, you still like the adventure.
Well, I can't wait to see it. I was a big Star Trek fan myself, although I don't think I'm as big as you are.
I am. Geekdom prevails. I am out of control. I'm so
All
excited.
Right, fellow geeks, gather around. Coming up here on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle, we're going to be talking to the owner of BookBeat in Oak Park and talking about brick-and-mortar stores, bookstores. They're not out of fashion yet. Well, one of the many things that Rochelle and I have in common is that we both love books. And
absolutely.
Rochelle even worked at a library.
One of the best jobs I ever had.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite places, of course, in the planet is to go to a good bookstore. But as we all know, they're few and far between. Rochelle, I know you saw this week, Amazon opening a brick-and-mortar bookstore.
Can you believe that? If you can't beat them, join them. It's like, okay.
Well, we wanted to talk to someone who's owned a bookstore here in the metropolitan Detroit area for a long time, been pretty Ooh. Successful at it. Carrie Lauren joins us. He's the co-owner of the BookBeat in Oak Park. Great bookstore. If you haven't been there, shameless commercial. Go to that bookstore.
Go.
We're glad. You know, what do you think about all this? Is it crazy or what?
It's a little nutty, yeah, but it's kind of, I think he's been planning this a very long time. I think he's always really admired bookstore, you know, the physical book and the physical bookstore, although he's, you know, made a living knocking them down.
You're talking about Jeff Bezos?
Yeah, he's like the 900-pound gorilla, you know, that's tried to decimate, you know, bookstores across the country.
Well, one of the things that you can't do on Amazon is to touch and feel and have a tactile experience with a book,
mm-hmm.
which is why, you know, there's still a few bookstores left. What do you think is going to be the impact of this? Is this going to encourage people to open bookstores? Is it going to provide a sense of relief to the bookstores that have endured like yours?
Yeah, I think there has been a little backlash even before this came out.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a return to bookstores. I think people like the social, the community and the social scene that they get inside a bookstore, you know, because it's more than just a space. It's a very, you know, it's a unique kind of space for people to be in. And
well, Carrie, I was telling Marie, as someone who literally worked in our public library in my small town, you
mm-hmm.
know, right up until I went away to college, it was an experience for me. It was something that I felt and smelled and
right.
loved. And one of the things I wondered is, well, and I, one of the things I told Marie is that I I love the library, but I also want bookstores to survive. Yes. So every time I go to the library and check out a book, I kid you not, I go to the bookstore and buy a book.
Yes.
So once a month, I'm still building up a new library.
Right.
Do you have people who have always stayed with you, who, you know, they don't want to go and have a digital experience? They come and they're regulars.
Yeah, we do have a lot of loyal customers, but, you know, a lot of bookstores have gone out of business that have had that mm-hmm. too. You know, but it takes a community to really make the bookstore and to keep supporting it. And, you know, people vote with their money. And if they don't want the corner drugstore or the hardware store, they're going to get sort of a mass marketed thing.
the generic thing.
Yeah.
Carrie, tell us about the customers who come to your store.
Oh, well, I think we have just a wide variety, but I think the people that really strongly support us are families, they're educators, they're people with children that really need some sort of, that need a little bit of guidance, that want a wide selection of children's books or literature. And, you know, just I think people do like discovering things in our store, too. You know, we're not always jumping on top of people there, but, you know, we're there to answer questions if people need it. And, you know, I think that it's also kind of a social space. You know, like I said, it's a place where you can browse and really make discoveries. And that's an important thing a bookstore offers. It's that kind of, you know, where you just wander through a space or a library, and you pick something up, and it leads to something else, or, you know, it catches your eye, and there's a lot of that going on, I think.
Well, you know, Marie asked about your customers. Tell us about the people who are there and how long you and they have been there serving people.
Well, we've been there 33 years, a little bit over.
33
that.
Years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Almost as old as I am.
Yeah, but, I mean, people, I think Amazon will learn this, too, that, you know, and they've been operating at a loss for years, but you don't open a bookstore really to make money.
Right.
It's something that grows from a love of books and you know, and learning, and, you know, the culture of books is just a different, you know, world.
Well, if you talk about, you told Rochelle that lots of bookstores that have a loyal clientele have closed down. I know you've seen a lot of it there mm-hmm. in Oakland County. So why have you been able to keep your doors open? What's the secret sauce?
Well, the secret sauce is my wife, Colleen. And she's like,
it's always the wife, just FYI.
Yeah. No, she is. She's because she really, I think she's taken on a mission with books, and she is out there in the community, at libraries, at schools, constantly, you know, serving this community. And she's it's just hard work, you know. Mm. It's not a secret, but it's just devotion
and a calling and a mission.
Yes.
Well, we wish you a lot of luck, continued success with the Book Beat in Oak Park, and again, warning, commercial, you must go to this bookstore.
Thanks
it's
so
an
much,
awesome
Ruth.
Bookstore.
Absolutely. We're going to put the address on our Twitter feed, In the Mix WJR.
Oh, we love you guys.
Oh, absolutely. And on our Facebook page, In the Mix WJR. And if you want to send us questions about your favorite book or about literacy, you can email inthemixwjr@gmail.com, and we might read your sentiments on the air.
We'd love to do that. Thanks again, Carrie. Good luck, and hugs
Thank
to
you.
Your wife.
Keep reading.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle is sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Once again, here's Marie and Rochelle.
There are very few diseases that are as heartbreaking and affect families as much as Alzheimer's, a type of dementia that causes problems with memory, thinking, behavior. And we are happy to have with us Dr. Christine Chelladurai, a geriatrician at Beaumont, and also from the Geriatric Evaluation Center in St. Clair Shores, to talk to us about this illness. This is National Alzheimer's Month, so we want people to pay particular attention in November. And Dr. Christine, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you know, I know that we focus on numbers to get a sense of how big a problem this is or how many people it strikes. Do you have some general sense of how many people are affected by this illness?
Absolutely. I have, I don't have specific numbers, but it is a growing problem. And especially as the population is growing older and we are living longer, it is going to be a significant problem. And it is something that we're going to see more and more of. And the risks of developing Alzheimer's specifically does increase as we get older, because it is a disease that affects mostly older adults. There are younger adults that do get affected by Alzheimer's disease as well, but it's more common in the older adults.
Dr. Christine, we understand that Alzheimer's is a type of dementia, causes problems with memory, thinking, behavior. But tell us, where do we stand today in terms of understanding dementia? It just seems this is one of those diseases, one of those medical problems, where we still have 90% that we don't understand and we don't know.
You're absolutely correct. We don't know much about it. We are learning things every day. And that's just the unfortunate situation we're in right now with this particular condition, dementia, and then also Alzheimer's disease, which is a type of dementia. Researchers and science, there's constant studies that are happening looking into how can we prevent some of these degenerative changes from happening in the brain, because it is a progressive degenerative condition that at this point we do not have a cure. So we do have a handful of medicines that can be used that are not curative, unfortunately, but may help delay the progression. But it's really, at this point, we don't have any cure, and it's really about identifying the signs and symptoms early enough, and we want to identify the issues early enough so that we can initiate more preventative strategies that may help delay the progression.
Now, Dr. Christine, there are lots of people who have difficulty remembering things.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is just, I've lost my car once a week for the past several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any type of tell or any type of specific symptom that you have a sense that this is not just typical forgetfulness and this really is something more serious?
Yes, this is a very important question, and I get asked this a lot. You know, when do you say, oh, this is just, getting older, or is my memory lapses really more of an issue? And the simple answer to that is some memory loss is common when we get older because of the changes that happen in our brain that are normal to us getting older. But it is when these memory lapses are actually affecting our ability to function, that is when it is an issue. Because normal age-related memory loss, you should still be able to do the things that you normally do. Yes, you may have forgotten where you parked your car, but eventually you do find it, or something triggers you to go, oh yes, it must be over there. Or you are still able to drive to your appointments, you're not getting lost, you're still able to drive to new places and be able to acclimate to new directions, you're still able to take your medications regularly, things like that. But in someone who has a possible cognitive impairment, such as dementia, their actual function is affected. And that could be a sign that, this could not just be a normal thing. We need to get this checked out.
Rochelle brings up such a good point, because someone in my family had dementia. And so, mm-hmm. of course, I worry about it all the time. time. And I remember a geriatrician telling us that, telling my brothers and I that, you know, this is runs in families, so you all need to know that and you need to be aware of that. So I worry about this all the time, but I had a doctor once tell me that, in like the example Rochelle gave us about I can't find the car, well, when you actually forget what the key is for,
that's frightening.
Then that's when you have a problem. I lost my keys, but when you forget what the keys are for, that's the problem. So, but let's talk a little bit about this issue of running in families. How much do we know about that? Is it really something that runs in families?
We are realizing more and more with our researchers and our scientists that genes do play an important role in development and in development of this condition, and there is a hereditary link specifically with Alzheimer's disease. But that being said, knowing that about your family history is important for the generations to be aware of, but what we know right now is we have isolated maybe some a particular gene, say perhaps, that does carry an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. But on the other end of that, just even if you do have that particular gene per se, doesn't necessarily constitute for you to develop Alzheimer's in the future. And I know that's very confusing, but what we do know is there is a hereditary genetic link to it, and it's important to be aware of your family history. But as far as, is that going to change your ability to your eventuality of getting the disease, it's not certain.
We just don't know.
And is it true that even if you don't have any hereditary path in your family, it's still possible for you?
Exactly.
Well, I want to ask a different question because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm looking at this information from the Alzheimer's Association. I learned much more. You don't know what you don't know until you start reading things. The brain has 100 billion nerve cells or neurons. So when, you know, a few of those misfire, that's a lot to look for, you know, sort of needles in haystack. But the interesting thing that they said was that the most common early symptom is difficulty remembering new information, trying to do something new, like me wanting to go and get an advanced degree now, as opposed to when I should have done it 20 years ago. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether we're talking about new learning or old learning? Does an Alzheimer's patient remember college but can't remember lunch?
Right. And this goes back to what are some of the normal changes that happen in our brain, whether you have dementia or not. As we age, there are changes happening at a structural level, at a molecular and neurochemical level that's happening in the brain. So learning new information can get harder as we get older, but that does not mean you cannot learn and retain new information. So, you know, the old adage, you know, oh, an old dog can't learn new tricks. That's not true for us. We can still learn something new. It can be harder to learn, but you can still learn new things. So someone with dementia who is where there's actual impediment to those processes of obtaining new information and learning new information, you know, that is not normal. That is an abnormal thing that even a normal aging brain should be able to do, is learn that new information. Mm-hmm. And in milder stages of the disease, patients are still able to function well because our brain is this wonderful complex organ. A lot of the things are day-to-day routines. People who have routines, it becomes almost like an habitual activity to where the brain isn't really doing a lot of the thinking. But it is when you're trying to see, you might see a person with mild disease and really say, oh, you know, they're doing well, you know, they're functioning well. And that's because they've developed a routine. And it is when you take them out of the routine and you put them in a new situation where they have to learn something new or participate in something new, that's when you see the difficulty in coping with that change or adapting to that change.
Former President Reagan called it the long goodbye. And I always thought mm-hmm. that was so apropos. Very quickly, there are people who are going to listen to this, families who are dealing with this. What's a good resource to get help? What's the one bit of good advice you can give to someone listening that's trying to deal with this struggle?
My one advice is talk to your physician. When you're noticing this in yourself or in your loved one, have a conversation with your physician, your regular primary care physician, and they can then help then steer you to the right resources, whether it is to get a referral to a geriatrician like me, or and then we can, as a geriatrician, we can help you get those resources and point you in the right direction in finding out what's happening. But my one thing is, if you're seeing signs of your loved ones, they're not, you know, their memory problems are affecting their function, talk to your physician.
Well, that sounds like great, great advice. We've been talking with Dr. Christine Chelladurai, geriatrician at Beaumont Hospital. You're listening to In the Mix on Sunday afternoon, and we'll be back.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Here's Rochelle Riley.
One of Detroit's great claims to fame is the Diego Rivera mural that exists
Industry.
On a whole wall, mm-hmm. Industry and the heart of Detroit, and the arsenal of democracy. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk with an artist who is going to have his own 30 by 30 foot canvas to do what he wants as a muralist, and that is the amazing Hubert Massey, who's going to paint the second floor of Cobo Center. Welcome, Hubert. May I call you Hubert?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. You have got to be excited to have this big a canvas. I have no idea what the largest one before this one was, but why don't you tell us about it?
Well, some of the largest pieces I've done, I did the Athenaeum Hotel, which is 30 feet high, 15 feet wide. It's a diptych, mm-hmm. on both sides. Probably one of the largest frescoes I did was the Flynn Institute of Arts Museum. 17 feet high, 88 feet long.
Oh, 88 feet long. Wow. Well, mm-hmm. so this fits somewhere in the middle. Can you talk a little bit about this particular project? And are you excited? Are you ready? Have you already made plans? Can you tell I'm excited for you?
Yeah, I'm extremely excited. I just think given the opportunity to be able to produce a fresco on this type of magnitude, especially since Diego Rivera did the frescoes back in 1932, there hasn't been anything this large since then. And I'm truly excited about that.
Hubert, tell us, I'm always curious whenever an artist is faced with such a big project and face that it's also going to be a very public project. In other words, it's a space in Cobo Center that now is devoid of any real personality. You're gonna be putting a big handprint on this area. It'll be with us forever. How do you possibly pick a theme for that? What do you go through?
Well, one of the processes I do is I do community forums. I get people together. I put together a sort of an advisory board. It had 15 members. There was an advisory board. We also had some students were in, invited, just people in general just came in. Some of the major people that came in was like SICOM, city planning, DIA, some of the historians, community folks. And just art lovers.
So, what were they telling you? What was their theme?
Well, basically, they were just telling me the history of the city of Detroit. I do these community forums so I can hear stories that most people never hear about, you know. And I just think that just adds a real nice level or layer to put into the actual mural itself. Because a lot of people, when they come to the city of Detroit, they have different perceptions and all. But to hear some of the stories, like, I had no idea that Berry Gordy worked on the assembly line. And some of his ideas of producing Motown was based on the template of a factory worker.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of, like, you have the Supremes who dressed the same and who had these choreographic moves and all, and and just the process and the logistics that they went through to be able to produce these wonderful acts that we have in Detroit called Motown is phenomenal.
Well, one of the things you told the Detroit Free Press is that you want people to walk away with a sense of history and a sense of the diversity and richness of Detroit's culture, 300 years. 300 years, I mean, Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac, from him to now, that's a lot to cover. Is there going to be some defining thing that you've already thought about, or are you still trying to get what that seed is that's going to weave its way?
Yeah, I sort of got a pretty good idea. It's just a matter of just arranging the sort of the timeline. Of course, the Detroit River is so important, and of course, the Native Americans, and then it gets into the automotive, and then from the automotive, it also creates other industries other than cars. Like I said, we created music, and that's an industry in itself. So there's other industries, and then just sort of highlighting, certain iconic type of images that just gives a breath of the city of Detroit and its history and its culture.
Well, you're going to have a tiny little spot down in the corner for Marie and me, right?
There you go.
Our little microphones.
Just a tiny little
pen for Rochelle. Hubert, what's your background?
Well, my background is I originally played, which is pretty interesting. I was born in Flint and lived in Mount Morris, Michigan, went to Flint Beecher High School. Then I had a scholarship to play football for Grand Valley State University.
Wow.
And I ran track. So I was a pro prospect my sophomore year, and I was getting all these accolades and everything. And after my sophomore year, I suffered a knee injury.
Oh.
And so what was really nice about that, even though it doesn't sound nice, but what was nice about it, I had an opportunity to go to Europe to stay at the University of London, England, Slade Institute of Fine Art. Came back, met an artist by the name of Paul Collins and Randy Brown, who encouraged me to go on the sign painting, because if you wanted to paint, you need to go to a sign company or a shop where they painted 40-50 hours a week. So I came here to the city of Detroit. I graduated on a Friday. Monday, I came here to Detroit. I've been here for over 30 years.
Wow. A renaissance man.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Yeah. So working in the sign company, you know, all billboards up until 1992 were all hand-painted. So
I did not know that.
Yeah. And they were so photorealistic. They were all done in oils, and we worked in the studios, and sometimes we worked on locations. And so that's what I did for 12 years until the digital age came in. And the digital age changed everything. So a lot of, remember, you used to have a lot of places where you get your film developed and all those places closed down. I used to do some illustrations for Detroit Free Press.
Oh, wow.
Detroit
Yay.
News. And so it all changed. And then what happened was I was just in the process of making a bridge. And the bridge came when I did the Athenaeum hotel, right. The Athenaeum Hotel, and that was back in 1992. That was 23 years ago, and that was my first commission in the city of Detroit.
Now, you know, Cobo only has, they have fewer than 100 pieces of art now that, you know, they mm-hmm. want to get real serious about putting a lot of art in to go with this nearly $300 million expansion. And yours, of course, will be the largest.
Mm-hmm.
It will be sort of the defining piece for this whole structure. Do you have a specific style or a specific something about your artwork that says this is a Hubert Massey? You know, when you look at a Gauguin or you look at Salvador Dali, you know who they are. Is there mm-hmm. something about your frescoes that people go, oh, I recognize that?
It's probably going to be based on my composition.
Mm-hmm.
My composition is it's sort of like this dynamic symmetry. I use a lot of the golden ratios, pretty much what Diego Rivera does, and David Alfaro Siqueiros, and also Orozco Clemente, a lot of the Mexican mural painters, they use the same process. I always tell people, I say, how do you start a painting or a large piece of artwork? Do you start in the middle? If you had to do a 20-foot by 70-foot, you start in the middle or the right-hand corner. And people say, well, I don't know where you start at. I guess you just pick an area and just start. But and for doing large pieces of artwork to hold things together, you need to build a composition.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to build a structure, just like building a building. You need a frame. And then you can put your the bricks on the outside of the building and all, but you need something to be able to hold that structure together.
The house that Massey built.
It wouldn't be possible if I didn't have some of the donors like the Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affair and the National Endowments of the Arts for their support. In part of this community project.
Hubert Massey, you're a Detroit muralist, and you'll be painting a beautiful mural that we can't wait to see at the Cobo Center. 1.4 million people visit Cobo every year, so this is going to be an important piece of artwork for our city. Good luck to you. We can't wait to see it.
Oh, thank you so very much.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
Well, you know, Rochelle and I have a mission here at In the Mix. Of course, conversation you care about, that's number one. But we like to bring in the guys and talk a little bit about some of men's health issues as well on the show. And Movember is upon us, Rochelle. So if you see a lot of guys running around with mustaches and beards, you'll know why. Movember.
Absolutely.
Tom Whiteside's joining us. He's the business manager and community engagement manager for Movember Foundation. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are y'all?
Good. So tell us, you know, we see folks running around. I know some of the pro teams, sports teams, all the guys are growing their beards. You see it on TV, guys are growing their beards. Tell us about Movember. How did it start to help raise awareness for men's health issues?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the Movember is all about the mustache.
It isn't the beard, but you know some guys are doing beards.
That's right. It gets a little confusing. So it actually started in Australia in 2003 around this notion of bringing the mustache back. These guys on a Sunday afternoon were having a conversation and said, whatever happened to the mustache? In the 70s and 80s, everybody had them, the rock stars, celebrities, athletes. And they set out to bring back the mustache in November. In Australia, the nickname for mustache is a mo, hence the name Movember.
There we are.
Per the rules, you actually start the month clean shaven and you grow just the mustache for the 30 days. And in doing so, you're going to spark these conversations around men's health, right? The idea was that guys don't talk about their health. We don't pay attention. We don't go to the doctor. And in growing these mustaches, it's actually going to get guys to spark these conversations. People say, hey, what are you doing? Why are you growing this mustache? You look hilarious. And it gets guys talking about their health.
Well, that is a great way to get something started. I know, you know, we've got pink ribbons for women. We've got red hats.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, mustaches. But this is huge. You've raised $650 million globally since 2003, and you have all types of programs. I just have to ask, why did you pick November?
Well, so like I said, these two Aussie guys on this Sunday afternoon, it must have been sometime in the early fall, and they said, because it's called a mo in Australia, they said, hey, let's go to the mo this November. And so they decided to do it in the month of
that
November.
Simple. Okay.
That simple.
Yeah,
so it has nothing to do with being lazy and not wanting to shave.
No, because in fact, you still actually have to do something. Now, you save a couple valuable seconds on your upper lip, but you still have to clean the rest of the face. So it's no beards and no goatees per the rule.
Okay, got it. Now tell me, how big has this gotten nationwide?
Yeah, so what started as a joke in 2003 began raising funds in 2004 in Australia, and then it moved to New Zealand, and then to mainland Europe, and then to North America. So we're now actually in 21 countries, and as you mentioned, we've raised over $650 million to date. We funded over 1,000 breakthrough programs, and we've had millions of participants, we call them Mo Bros and Mo Sisters, take part in Movember.
Oh, that sounds like y'all got a little bit of soul going on there, Tom. Now, there are some very serious matters behind this. You found a great way to get people comfortable talking about something that guys don't usually like to talk about. But you've got some real focuses here. Testicular cancer, which is the most common cancer in young men aged 15 to 34. Prostate cancer. Poor mental health. How do you connect with the professionals and connect those professionals to men who, in some cases, just don't like to go to the doctor?
Yeah, so we work with Men's Health Partners on the ground, for example, the Prostate Cancer Foundation, which is out here in Los Angeles, and we run programs ourselves. We have a programs team, mostly out of Australia, but with members in each of our big four countries. And yeah, it's all about getting these guys to open up, start that conversation, actually seek help, take action when a problem occurs. Most of our base is on the younger side. You know, it's a lot of guys in their 20s and 30s. So, for example, prostate cancer isn't a concern yet. But if you can get a 30-year-old guy thinking about his health, knowing the warning signs of prostate cancer, learning his family health history, and starting that annual conversation with his doctor, if and when a problem does occur, he's going to have a much earlier diagnosis and therefore a better outcome.
I had no idea that prostate cancer is the second most common cancer in men in the U.S. Is that tell us what's the number one health problem among men? Is it prostate? Is it testicular cancer?
Prostate. So I think there's actually more lung cancer diagnoses total, but prostate cancer affects about 1 in 7 men in the United States.
Oh.
And if you have a family health history, so let's say you had a dad, an uncle, a grandfather, your rate is actually closer to 1 in 3. The same goes for African-American men. This is not often talked about, but African-American men have a much higher likelihood of getting prostate cancer. It's also closer to 1 in 3. And guys don't talk about it. You know, so the rates are similar to that of breast cancer.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of awareness and funding around breast cancer, which is, of course, great. And we've followed in those footsteps around the health movement for women. And what we want guys to do is take notice and take action, right? This is going to affect about 1 in 7 guys in the U.S. It is a very treatable disease. It has a very high cure rate, but like most cancers, early diagnosis is key. So it's getting guys to actually start to think about these things, take action, start that conversation with their doctor. And again, if and when something does arise, get an earlier diagnosis and a better outcome.
And you know, when you cite statistics like that, 1 in 7, for a lot of those ones, there's a woman involved, a wife, mm-hmm. a sister, a mother. Can you tell us a little bit more about most sisters? I'm sorry, was it most sisters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most sisters.
Yes.
That's
okay.
Right.
Oh, yeah, no, not most sisters, most sisters. Gotcha.
So we know that women tend to be the gateway to help in a man's life. So whether it's our mother, our wife, a girlfriend, a colleague, a niece, a daughter, it's usually the women in our lives that actually get us to go to the doctor, right?
Nag,
we kind of drag our
nag,
feet,
nag.
Right? You guys know. And it's, you know, y'all do the gentle or sometimes not so gentle nudging. And that actually gets us to go to the doctor. And so what Movember was born out of was this, you know, they were inspired by the women in their lives, the health movement around women. And so we still ask women to take part. Obviously, we don't ask them to grow mustaches. But traditionally, we get women to support the men in their lives, so they can be starting a team at Movember.com, doing some fundraising, talking to the guys in their lives, saying, hey, when's the last time you got a checkup? And then new this year, we have a program called MOVE, which incidentally are the first four letters of Movember, M-O-V-E. And the idea is that you make a commitment to move every day of Movember. So that could be something as simple as taking a walk at lunch, going for a swim in the evening, going for a bike ride on the weekend, and basically being active all 30 days in Movember. So a big ask this year for both the guys, especially the gals, the tangible way to take part is this commitment to move.
Well, Tom, we wish you a lot of luck. This is a great, great thing. We see so many more guys now growing their mustaches, and we wanted to know more about it.
Absolutely. You guys are in Motown, so I would expect to see
you. Amen.
Thank you guys so much.
Well, that's another episode of In the Mix with Maria and Rochelle, conversation you care about. You can find us at In the Mix WJR on Twitter or on Facebook at In the Mix WJR.
And we want to thank Laura Hessen today, Mark Blackwell. Those are the folks who help us put the show on the air. And you. We're really delighted you could join us today. See you again next week.